Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 225. It's Monday, August 21st. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, first up from Reuters, U.S. suicide deaths reached record high in 2022. The number of people who died by suicide in the U.S. hit an estimated record 49,000 in 2022, a 2.6% increase over the prior year, government data showed last Thursday. Over half of all U.S. suicides in 2022 involved firearms, according to figures from the CDC. The suicide rate in 2022, 15 deaths for every 100,000 people, is 5% higher than the previous record high set in 2018. And in somewhat better news, this from Medical Express, cancer screenings have saved the U.S. at least $6.5 trillion, study estimates. Americans have gotten at least 12 million more lives, years of life to live because of preventive cancer screenings they've gotten over the past 25 years, a new study estimates. That adds up to at least $6.5 trillion in added economic impact because of scans and tests that look for early signs of breast, colon, cervical, and lung cancer in adults at the highest risk. That doesn't include the dollars saved in medical care by treating cancer at an earlier stage rather than a later stage. The findings underscore the importance of efforts to encourage even more people to get their recommended cancer checks done and to develop and test new ways to screen for other cancers. If everyone who qualified for current screening for those four forms of cancer received it, at least another 3.3 million life years could have been saved and another $1.7 trillion in economic impact added, the researchers find. In all, they estimate that 417 million Americans over that time period were eligible for the four types of cancer screening, that is from 1996 to 2020. The majority, more than 58% of the life years saved and economic impact in the study, came from cervical cancer screening. That's because of the early start and long duration of screening, which is recommended to be done at regular intervals in all individuals between the age 18 and 65 who have a cervix. Screening can be done by a Pap test or a test for HPV, the virus that causes most cervical cancer. However, the authors note that the availability of an HPV vaccine since 2006 may impact the future preventive value of cervical cancer screening. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is currently preparing to evaluate research that includes vaccination status as it revisits its recommendations. The authors note that there is not validated screening tests for broad groups of people for many other kinds of cancer. In fact, 70% of cancer deaths are from cancers without a validated test, while death rates from cancer with available screening tests have fallen, which fuels the overall drop in cancer deaths in the U.S. And next up, also for Medical Express, another cancer story. Unfortunately, this one's not as good news. Risk of cancer death after exposure to low-dose ionizing radiation underestimated, suggests study of nuclear industry. Prolonged exposure to low-dose ionizing radiation is associated with a higher risk of death from cancer than previously thought, suggests research tracking the death of workers of the nuclear industry, published in the British Medical Journal. The findings should inform current rules on workplace protections from low-dose radiation, says the researchers. To date, estimates of the effects of radiation on the risk of dying from cancer have been based primarily on studies of survivors of atomic bombs dropped on Japan at the end of the Second World War. These estimates are used to set the level of protection required for workers regularly exposed to much lower doses of radiation in the nuclear industry and other sectors such as healthcare. But the latest data from the International Nuclear Workers Study suggests that risk estimates based on the acute exposures among atomic bomb survivors to an extremely high dose of radiation may underestimate the cancer risk from exposure to much lower doses of ionizing radiation delivered over a prolonged period in the workplace. The researchers therefore tracked and analyzed deaths among 310,000 workers in the nuclear industry in the UK, France, and the US, for whom individual monitoring data for external exposure to ionizing radiation were available. The researchers then used this information to estimate the risk of death from solid cancers based on workers' exposure to radiation 10 years previously. They estimated that this risk increased by 52% for every unit of radiation. But when the analysis was restricted to workers who had been exposed to the lowest cumulative doses of radiation, this approximately doubled the risk of death from solid cancers per unit absorbed. Similarly, restricting analysis only to workers hired in more recent years, when estimates of occupational external penetrating radiation doses were more accurate, also increased the risk of death from solid cancer per unit radiation absorbed. People often assume that low-dose radiation exposures pose less carcinogenic hazard than the high-dose radiation exposures experienced by the Japanese atomic bomb survivors, write the researchers. Our study does not find evidence to reduce risk per unit dose for solid cancer among workers typically exposed to radiation at low dose rates. They hope that organizations such as the International Commission on Radiological Protection will use their results to inform their assessment of the risks of low dose and low dose rate radiation, and ultimately in an update of the system of radiological protection. And of course, I reported recently that Fukushima is going to release millions and millions and millions of gallons of low-dose radiation into the world's oceans, shared by all of us, under sort of the kind of dilution is the solution kind of framework, but that doesn't really work with radiation, which pretty much has a direct effect on the amount of ionizing radiation you are exposed to for cancer. Okay, next up, in another environmental onslaught, this from The Guardian, EPA's new definition of PFAS could omit thousands of forever chemicals. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency office, responsible for protecting the public from toxic substances, has changed how it defines PFAS for the second time since 2001, a move critics say they fear will exclude thousands of forever chemicals from regulation and largely benefit industry. Instead of using a clear definition of what constitutes a PFAS, the agency's Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics plans to take a, quote, case-by-case approach that allows it to be more flexible in determining which chemicals should be subjected to regulations. Among other uses for the compounds, the EPA appears to be excluding some chemicals in pharmaceuticals and pesticides that are generally defined as PFAS, current and former EPA officials say, and the shift comes amid fierce industry opposition to proposed limits on the chemicals. The approach puts the toxic office at odds with other EPA divisions, other federal agencies, the European Union, Canada, and most of the scientific world. The definition is likely to generate confusion in the chemical industry and within the agency, current and former EPA officials say. This is not a new definition. It is a lack of a definition, and it makes no sense, said Linda Birnbaum, a former EPA scientist and head of the National Toxicology Program. It is just going to lead to terrible confusion. PFAS, or per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, are a class of about 15,000 compounds, most frequently used to make products water stain and grease resistant. They have been linked to cancer, birth defects, decreased immunity, high cholesterol, kidney disease, and a range of other serious health problems. They are dubbed forever chemicals because they do not naturally break down in the environment and build up in the body. Current and former EPA employees say the agency is not defining some fluorinated chemicals used in pesticides as PFAS at a time when research has discovered their widespread use in agricultural products. The agency also excludes some ultra-short-change PFAS refrigerants, which are defined as PFAS by the European Union, but not the Toxics Office, said Tim Whitehouse, a former EPA attorney, now with the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility nonprofit. He said the stricter regulations in Europe have forced the industry away from the kind of PFAS refrigerants produced by Chemours, a chemical manufacturer with a plant in North Carolina. Chemours opposes defining the refrigerants as PFAS, quote, because it is going to destroy their market. as it has in Europe. The consequences of the EPA's narrower definition have already been felt in North Carolina's Cape Fear Basin, which is contending with decades of Chemours pollution. A 2019 citizen group petition asked the EPA to conduct studies that would shed light on the health impacts of 54 PFAS compounds found in human blood and water in the region. In the agency's December 2021 response, it declined to test for 15 chemicals that said, quote, do not meet the Toxics Office PFAS definition. The change also creates uncertainty for chemical companies who are producing substances that may or may not fall within the definition, says Kyla Bennett, a former EPA official, characterized as, quote, insanely frustrating. The EPA claims they switched to a case-by-case definition to remain flexible, but in the past it says, we want to provide regulatory certainty, but this is the furthest from regulatory certainty that I can think of, she added. The White House's Office of Science and Technology coordinates among federal agencies, could provide guidance to federal agencies on which definition to use, but it has failed to do so, Bennett said. The bottom line is the EPA has one job, and that is to protect human health and the environment. And when it comes to PFAS, they are not, she added. Okay, next I want to turn to a series of stories about licit, illicit, and prescription drugs, all of which America consumes the majority of in the world. First up, from USA Today, marijuana usage and binge drinking hit historic levels among U.S. adults. Binge drinking, vaping, marijuana use, and hallucinogen consumption reached an all-time high among adults in the U.S. last year, reflecting a significant upward trajectory in substance use in recent years, a new study shows. New research from the University of Michigan's Monitoring the Future panel revealed that middle-aged adults aged 35 to 50 are using marijuana and hallucinogens at record levels. Binge drinking had spiked to the highest prevalence ever recorded for this age group, the panel study reported last Thursday. For younger adults aged 19 to 30, marijuana use and nicotine vaping saw a sharp increase over the past 5 years, climbing to the highest levels ever seen. About 44% of young adults reported using marijuana in the past year, an increase from 28% about a decade ago. Daily marijuana use reached its highest level in that age group, nearly doubling from 10 years ago, with more than 1 in 10 using cannabis almost every day. For adults aged 30 to 50, marijuana use more than doubled compared with 10 years ago, with 28% reporting having used the drug. Young and middle-aged adult groups use hallucinogens such as LSD, MDMA, mescaline, peyote, mushrooms, or psilocybin, and PCP at a significantly higher rate compared with 10 years ago. Among adults aged 19 to 30, 8% reported use of hallucinogens in the past year, and 4% of adults aged 35 to 50 years old reported use. Nicotine vaping among young adults nearly doubled over the past 5 years, from 14% in 2017, when the measure was first added to the survey, to 24% in 2022. Binge drinking for the middle age group had reached its highest levels in 2022 at 29%, compared with 25% in 2017 and 23% in 2012. Almost 30% of middle-aged adults reported having 5 or more consecutive drinks in the past 2 weeks. And as just a reminder, more than 140,000 Americans die from the effects of alcohol every year, the National Center for Drug Abuse Statistics says. And next up from Axios, Gen Z millennials increasingly view alcohol use as unhealthy, poll says. More than half of young adults in the U.S. see even moderate drinking, 1 or 2 drinks a day, as unhealthy, new Gallup polling found. Why it matters? Views on alcohol and drugs are shifting rapidly, especially among millennials and Gen Z Americans. Americans now see booze as more harmful than marijuana. A record high 39% of Americans believe moderate drinking is detrimental to health, up 11 points since 2018. Among 18 to 34-year-olds, there was an 18-point jump, the biggest among any age group. 50% of Americans polled said alcohol makes no difference for health, and 10% said it was good for health. The correct answer is that alcohol is not good for your health. It's amazing that half Americans said it makes no difference whatsoever. But even at modest consumptions, it does not add to health. Of course, there was decades when there was thinking that modest amounts of alcohol actually improved your health. That has turned out not to be true. And in more polling, this from Axios, America's biggest fears. Opioid surge past guns and Axios Ipsos poll. Economic and political turmoil, along with unease about developments like AI, have left many Americans numb to public health threats, though issues like the opioid crisis and shortage of cancer drugs are still registering. Gun violence, which ranked as the top threat to public health when we asked the question in May, has dropped to number three behind opioids and obesity, with noticeably fewer Democrats listing it as their top concern. What they found? On COVID, 50% somewhat or strongly agree the pandemic is over, compared to 62% in May. So less people think it's over than in May. That's an interesting trend. The percentage of people who wear a mask some or all the time has dropped by half over the past 6 months to 15%. So behaviorally, that's definitely less concern. 69% say contracting COVID poses small or no risk to their health and well-being. The public's awareness of other health issues is comparatively low. Fewer than half say they're somewhat or very familiar with record-high drug overdose deaths. The ongoing shortages of some cancer drugs or the FDA's approval of the over-the-counter birth control pill. Still, they said they cared about those issues when asked about them. In sizing up what most concerns them, the perceived threat of gun violence appears to be more acutely tied to specific events like widely covered mass shootings, while opioid misuse or obesity is more of a constant worry. Where a person lives is a big factor. Substantially more people in rural areas rank opioids and fentanyl as a top concern than those in urban and suburban areas, who are likely to rank firearms high on their list. And next up, regarding fatal drug overdoses, this from MedPage Today, some health workers see double the risk for fatal drug overdoses. Certain healthcare workers, including registered nurses, were at increased risk for fatal drug overdoses, a longitudinal study from 2008 to 2019 found. After adjustment for various factors, the risk for overdose death was more than twofold higher in RNs at 2.2 times, and social and behavioral health workers at over 2.5 times, that would be social workers and therapists and the like, when compared with non-healthcare workers. Increased risk was seen among healthcare support workers as well, with a 60% greater risk, while physicians, health technicians, and other treating or diagnosing health workers had no higher risk, according to the findings in the Annals of Internal Medicine. So, working in a healing place can be dangerous in and of itself. Of course, when you're around a lot of prescription drugs, that can sometimes lead to trouble. Well, next up, also from Medical Express, an interesting story. I recently reported that many folks undergoing cancer treatment and survivors continue to smoke. Well, the same seems to be true of drinking behaviors. Drinking, often heavy, is common among cancer survivors. Many Americans diagnosed with cancer continue to drink alcohol regularly, sometimes heavily and sometimes during treatment, a new study shows. A study of over 15,000 U.S. cancer survivors found that 78% were current drinkers, and of them, significant percentages said they binged or engaged in other risky drinking. The same patterns were seen even among people undergoing cancer treatment. Experts said the findings are concerning, in part because alcohol increases the risk of certain cancers. Drinking during cancer treatment, meanwhile, may interfere with the effectiveness of some therapies or boost the chances of side effects. Most people know that smoking causes cancer, he said, but not many people are aware that alcohol use is a risk factor. 30% report hazardous drinking. That was based on a standard questionnaire that doctors use to screen for problem drinking. It asks people how often they drink, how much they have, and how often they binge. The researchers found that active cancer treatment did not seem to alter people's drinking habits. Over 1,800 study participants had undergone cancer treatment in the past year, and their drinking habits during that time were nearly identical to other cancer survivors. That brings up another broader question. How often do healthcare providers ask cancer patients about their drinking habits and offer advice? And of course, substance abuse issues are very persistent and need to be addressed. They often just don't go away on their own. And next up, this story gets about just how widespread the impact of addiction is. This from Medical Express. Two-thirds of Americans say their lives have been affected by addiction. Millions of Americans are addicted to drugs or alcohol, and millions more struggle with an addicted family member or friend, a new poll finds. Two-thirds of those surveyed said either they or their family member have been addicted to alcohol or drugs, been homeless because of an addiction, or overdosed or died from drug use. Moreover, 19% say that they themselves have been addicted to drugs or alcohol, had a drug overdose, or were homeless because of an addiction. It's pretty surprising to think about when we talk about addiction and issues with drugs and alcohol. We typically talk about them as isolated incidents, said Ashley Kurzinger, director of survey methodology at Kaiser Family Foundation. Families affected by addiction say it has damaged family relations at 76%, and mental health, 70%, while it stresses family finances, 57%. Kurzinger also noted that both Democrats and Republicans support addiction treatment centers in their community at 90%. These services have historically been greatly underinvested in and separated from the public from the healthcare system. Often, addiction has been addressed punitively rather than through the needed public health approach. Let's get moving, people. Okay, next up, more news on the decriminalization front. This from Associated Press. A marijuana legalization question will be on Ohio's fall ballot after lawmakers failed to act on it. A proposal to legalize recreational adult use of marijuana in Ohio was cleared last Wednesday to appear on statewide ballots this fall after the Republican-led state legislature failed to act on it. The measure would allow adults 21 and over to buy and possess up to 2.5 ounces of cannabis and to grow plants at home. A 10% tax would be imposed on purchases to be spent on administrative costs, addiction treatment programs, municipalities with dispensaries, and social equity and jobs programs. If the issue passes, Ohio would become the 24th state to legalize cannabis for adult use. This isn't groundbreaking, Tim Herron, a coalition spokesman, said in a statement when the signatures were submitted. We're just trying to get Ohio in line with neighbors like Michigan and Illinois. Marijuana has been legal for medical use in the state since 2016. Okay, well, next up, let's turn our attention to prescription drugs. This from The Hill. Negotiations for lower drug prices are at risk again, this time in the courts. Back in 2003, when the Medicare prescription drug benefit was enacted into law, the pharmaceutical industry bought a sweetheart deal. The chairman of the key committee, Billy Towson, inserted into the bill the prohibition on Medicare negotiating directly with drug companies for lower prices. Shortly thereafter, Towson left Congress and went to work for the powerful industry trade association, Pharma, for a salary of $2 million a year. For almost 20 years, Pharma fought successfully to keep that sweetheart deal. Drug companies could dictate the price of medicines, and the government could not negotiate directly to get a better deal. That changed last year with passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which requires Medicare to negotiate for 60 of the most expensive drugs. With 80% support from the American people, Democrats in Congress overcame the drug industry's money and power and put an end to the sweetheart deal. But the drug corporations and their business associations aren't having it. They filed 6 lawsuits to block the new law with one overarching aim: to protect their power to charge Americans 3.5 times what other wealthy nations pay for the same brand-name drugs. There is no free market for prescription drugs in the U.S. Prices are a function of laws and regulations won by drug companies throughout the years. The current pricing system harms the health and financial well-being of U.S. patients and consumers. More than 1/3 of Americans say cost has prevented them from filling a prescription. 30% of prescriptions for cancer drugs were not filled. People of color, people with disabilities, the poor, and women are hurt most by high drug prices. We turned a corner last year to end the abuse of Americans by drug companies by passing the new drug law. So, will the industry succeed in using lawsuits to thwart the will of the people? The plain facts are that Medicare sets prices for everything else it pays for in healthcare: doctors, hospitals, and tests, for example. But drug companies say they won't negotiate and will fight having to do so using every tool at their disposal. They insist they must have the power to set the prices for the drugs we buy. What's more, the negotiating process under law requires that Medicare give central weight to the clinical value of the drug, whether it represents a therapeutic advancement, and to the extent which it meets an unmet need. In other words, drug companies will get higher prices for high-quality, innovative drugs. The law maintains that maintains the incentives for innovation that already exist in the U.S. by allowing drug makers to be rewarded for investment and risk by setting their launch prices, maintaining the FDA-awarded period of exclusivity, and exempting all medications from negotiated prices for a 9 to 13 year period. The Biden administration is defending the law and the will of the people. Exclusive prices for 9 to 13 years. That should be plenty. And of course, the pharmacy industry spends more on marketing than research. Don't buy those innovation arguments.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? from endemic racism that nobody seems to see. Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
And next up, a good example of differences in drug prices between the U.S. and other peer countries, this from The Hill. The U.S. pays more for newer weight loss drugs than its peers. The prices charged for drugs like Ozempic, Wegovy, and Mounjaro are significantly higher in the U.S. when compared with other wealthy nations, with the list price being 10 times lower in some countries, according to a new analysis from Kaiser Family Foundation. The analysis found a one-month supply of Ozempic, which is indicated for diabetes, but is sometimes prescribed for weight loss off-label, has a list price of $936 in the U.S. for the month's supply. And among the nine other countries looked at, none paid more than $200 for a month's supply of the same drug. So, in that case, like five times more expensive. And sticking to the drug front and doing a follow-up on the newest Alzheimer's drug, this from MedPage Today, few early Alzheimer's patients qualify for Leqembi. Few people with early Alzheimer's disease meet eligibility criteria for the new anti-amyloid monoclonal antibody treatments Leqembi, cross-sectional data from the Mayo Clinic study of aging showed. Of 237 people with mild cognitive impairment or mild dementia and increased brain amyloid on PET scans, clinical trial inclusion and exclusion criteria narrowed the number who would qualify for Leqembi to 19 or 8% of the cohort, said Maria Vasilaki of the Mayo Clinic and co-authors. Modifying the Leqembi exclusion criteria by not applying additional cognitive criteria led to 17% of participants with mild cognitive impairment being eligible for the trial, the researchers wrote in Neurology. Our study results show only a small percentage of people with early Alzheimer's disease may be eligible to receive treatment, mostly due to chronic health conditions and brain scan abnormalities that are common in older adults. In general, clinical trial participants are healthier than the general population, she pointed out. Additional research is needed to examine the safety and efficacy of monoclonal antibodies targeting amyloid beta plaques in larger, more diverse populations, as well as in less healthy populations, before these therapies may be more widely available to people with Alzheimer's disease, or actually we should say mild cognitive impairment, because once you develop Alzheimer's disease, you have to stop taking these drugs.
And now, for a word from our lack of sponsors, PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
And moving to some more healthcare stories, this from the Associated Press. Feds raise concern about long call center wait times as millions drop from Medicaid. As millions of Medicaid recipients face the potential loss of health coverage for the first time since the coronavirus pandemic, state call centers are getting inundated with questions from people needing help. In some states, federal officials say it's taking too long to get answers. Nearly one-third of the states have received warnings from federal Medicaid officials that their lengthy call center wait times may be causing people to hang up and give up as they attempt to renew Medicaid coverage amid a massive nationwide effort to clean up the rolls of the government health insurance program for lower-income residents. Among those 16 states, the average call center wait time was 25 minutes and the average hang-up rate was 29%. That's significantly higher than the rest of the states, where the average call wait was less than 3 minutes and the average hang-up rate was less than 6%. So we can see that we don't have good quality control in the government service as far as getting help with Medicaid renewal and determination for eligibility. We can do better. And next up, another story on biases in the health care system. This is from Medical Express. In emergency rooms, marginalized patients more likely to be skipped in line. In most U.S. emergency departments, patients are admitted in an order based on both the urgency of their condition and when they arrived. But in a new study, Yale researchers found that nearly 29% of emergency department patients are jumped in line, with those from marginalized groups, including lower income patients, non-white patients, and non-English speakers, more likely to be cut by others. This phenomenon, the researchers say, can affect patient outcomes and highlights the need for standardized procedures. The researchers also found that patients who were jumped over were more likely to leave before their care was completed and more likely to be placed in a hallway rather than a room. In the study, the researchers found no disparity in queue jumping when they assessed patients with the most severe scores, those experiencing stroke or trauma, for example. In those cases, there are clear protocols for what we do regarding treatment. And that this disparity goes away with this group of patients speaks to how well-defined protocols may help close these gaps.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, I usually don't talk about studies that don't have an effect, but this is a particular interesting because of what it points to. This from MedPage Today. Nurse home visit program shows no benefit for prenatal care uptake, pointing to larger social determinants. Sending registered nurses out on home visits throughout pregnancy failed to move the needle when it came to improving uptake of prenatal care, a randomized trial involving Medicaid patients found. In a study which enrolled 5,700 Medicaid-eligible pregnant people in South Carolina, a majority of whom were Black, also found no benefit with the Nurse Family Partnership Program on gestational weight gain or use of other healthcare services during pregnancy. Maternal mortality in the U.S. has more than doubled over the past two decades, with Black women facing disproportionately higher rates of pregnancy-related death. While nurse home visiting programs have long been seen as an evidence-based solution for improving maternal and child health, most of that evidence comes from studies conducted in the early 70s and 80s. This program centers around teaching healthy behaviors, emphasizing nutrition and exercise, and encouraging clients to go to prenatal visits and receive recommended care. Prior findings from the trial, however, showed that the program failed to reduce the risk of a composite of adverse birth outcomes versus usual care. But many of the factors that shape pregnancy outcomes are present before pregnancy, including an individual's overall health and many social circumstances. The challenges that are facing these populations are much bigger than things that nurse home visiting programs are well positioned to address during their pregnancy. It's assigning the responsibility for addressing those really big forces to one practitioner and one pregnant person, where I think we need larger structural changes to really move the needle on some of these things. And I'll just remind listeners that when you look at the huge disparity, 2.5-3 times in poor outcomes between black and white women, that actually is true even for very high socioeconomic black women compared to high socioeconomic white women. And of course, one of the reasons behind this is racism, a major social determinant of health. Okay, well, this next story is for those who think that that COVID and the flu are becoming pretty much the same thing. Want to disabuse you of that concept. This from the Centers for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Older discharge COVID patients at twice the risk of death as older flu patients, study finds. Older adults who are hospitalized for COVID have double the rate of death upon discharge as older adults hospitalized for influenza-related complications, according to a new study in the British Medical Journal. Patients with COVID also saw a six-fold higher rate of in-hospital deaths. 1/6 of Medicare enrollees died while hospitalized for COVID compared to just 2.7% for those hospitalized for flu. That's 16.6% versus 2.7% for the flu. In addition, the COVID-19 group had longer hospital stays than the flu group, 8.6 days versus 5.3 days. Yep, COVID is still doing damage and is still very dangerous. Okay, well, let's end the regular reporting with a little bit of better news on a somewhat kind of obscure issue. This is from Axios. The NFL announces more steps to reduce head injuries. The NFL's expanding use of the padded softshell caps that players have been wearing for the duration of preseason practices, as well as regular season contact practices, amid signs they're cutting down on concussions. Why it matters? Player safety has been under increased scrutiny, and the Guardian caps worn by offensive and defensive linemen, tight ends, and linebackers resulted in 52% fewer concussions up to the second preseason game this year, compared to an average of the same period over the previous three preseasons. Yes, but even with the public focus on concussions in the NFL, the league continues to struggle with reducing their frequency, reporting an 18% increase in serious head injury among players last season. Figuring out how to reduce injuries isn't only critical for professional athletes, but for the thousands of amateur football players, including kids. A study published last week found amateur football players may face an increased risk of developing Parkinson's disease. A 2021 study found youth tackle football athletes experience a median of 378 head impacts per athlete during the season and sustain 23 times more high-magnitude head impacts compared to those playing flag football. So if you're going to beat your heads together, wear a helmet, a really good helmet preferably. Of course, you'll notice in the NFL, they're not wearing these during the regular season because they look funny. Oh, vanity, oh, vanity. Okay, well, that brings us to our feature of bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 25 bonus articles this week. First up, environmental groups sue SoCal air regulator over ozone pollution for failing to impose regulatory fees on major industries polluting. So, environmental rules are better in Southern California, but of course, you have to actually enforce the rules that are on the books, so they're being forced to do that. More power to them. Bonus article 2. The EPA is rejecting calls for tougher regulation of big livestock farms. It's promising more study. Yeah, that's the end of every research study is doing more study. Unfortunately, our regulators, there's plenty we know about this. This is an issue all over the country, but particularly in the Midwest and Ohio and Michigan here in the Maumee Valley, where there's all kinds of pollution by concentrated animal feeding operations, most of which are not regulated. Federally, at least. There's some state regulations, but that's minimal as well. There are loopholes you can drive a truck through, literally. Bonus article 3. A new top cop at the EPA aims to get enforcement back on track. So this is good news. While there was a story I reported on the fact that The EPA seems to be getting weaker as far as making its PFAS definition, which might allow some polluters to get away with it. For those regulations that are on the books, this new top cop, the top regulator and enforcer of EPA regulations and laws, actually was the lawyer to first prosecute what was called an environmental justice case in the U.S. And looks like this is good news. It's a great story if you want to read, hopefully, about how you can do good work in government. I'm looking to see big things coming from there. Sticking to the environmental stories, a couple from Maui. Bonus Article 4. Maui wildfire survivors face new threat from chemical contamination that could linger for months. So I reported on this before. When you have floods and hurricanes and any kind of damage that jumbles things up, and particularly when you get a lot of water involved, like in floods or wildfires where things are burning, you get a lot of chemical contamination. All those things that are in businesses and homes that burn are thrown up in the air and spread all over the ground and into the water. And bonus Article 5 related, Maui water is unsafe even with filters. One of the lessons learned from fires in California. So there's so much toxic contamination being thrown up by these wildfires in Maui that it's making the water so unsafe that even with the best filters, you cannot get it down to a safe level. Bonus Article 6. Many users of skin lightening products are unaware of risks. So I reported recently and before about hair straightening products that definitely are carcinogenic. But skin lightening products are also very risky, and many users are not aware. So if you're interested in that, check that out. Bonus Article 7, teenage smokers have different brains than non-smoking teens. So that's one of the main reasons why you want to prevent smoking, certainly at a younger age, just because while brains are still developing, which is all through adolescence, even to an early adulthood, smoking changes your brain. And of course, the best way to prevent long-term cigarette smoking is not getting people addicted when they're young. And some of that addiction effect, how hard and difficult it is to overcome, is because it actually literally changes your brain. Bonus Article 8. Here's an interesting one. Eels, cocaine, and climate change. Forget cocaine bear and cocaine shark. To really understand the environmental threat of illicit drugs, look to eels. So I've reported before on the fact that prescription drugs or illicit drugs end up in water, and it affects ecosystems. And it looks like in some water systems that eels are the so-called canary in the coal mine. And just another interesting connection between drug use and climate change. Bonus Article 9. What does the U.S. abortion pill ruling mean for patients? So the appellate court ruled that there should be some restrictions on the abortion pill, but that is stayed until the Supreme Court decides on it. But reading this article will give you an idea. So there shouldn't be any big change now, but this will talk about the things that could happen if the Supreme Court rules and upholds any or all of the restrictions or makes bigger restrictions. Bonus Article 10. Why so few get screened for lung cancer, the deadliest cancer in the U.S.? So this is a follow-up to reporting I've done before, too, and it's a good example of kind of the complexity of the screening is so difficult that a lot of providers just kind of skip over it, but it's actually a very good cancer screening and could cut down the deadliest cancer in the U.S. Bonus Article 11. Removing race-corrected pulmonary function tests may alter lung cancer care. And by alter, they mean it's better for folks, for instance, who are black, who get race-corrected pulmonary function tests. And again, I've reported on this before. This is literally a holdover from slave days and racist health views that somehow the pulmonary function of black folks is different than white folks and often leads to less treatment of pulmonary issues among black folks. Bonus Article 12. A new Medicare proposal would cover training for family caregivers. So this is an interesting innovation. So many folks take care of family or loved ones. and very, very few actually get any formal training regarding what they're doing. Some may actually do a halfway decent job. Of course, you probably rely on the internet and friends and other people. But this new Medicare proposal would actually allow trained healthcare providers to train family or friends to be caregivers and hopefully do a much better job of that. A good advance. Bonus Article 13. The definition of clinical trial diversity must include disabled people. Now, with all the various disabilities, that covers actually about 1 in 4, 25% of Americans. And many of those disabled folks actually are some of the people that would benefit the most from the drugs that are their clinical trials on, yet they're excluded in many cases. So we really need to bolster up our game with clinical trials. And instead of allowing clinical trial scientists to exclude people sort of willy-nilly, open-ended, that you actually have firm rules that have to include a wide variety of people, including disabled folks. Bonus Article 14. Why doctors spend millions on fees that could be spent on providing care? The shift to electronic medical reimbursements give rise to payment processing companies demanding 1.5% to 5% fee every time a doctor gets paid by insurers. The government banned such fees until a company lobbyist got involved. Just another perversity in our healthcare system and capitalism as our economy gets more and more financialized. The money changers take their cut. Yeah, a little better news, bonus article 15. Low regret and high satisfaction long-term after gender-affirming mastectomy. So there's been some concern about whether people get the gender-affirming care, whether it's going to be, you know, regret or level of satisfaction. And this study, taking a look at that, shows that, in fact, there is very low levels of regret and very high levels of satisfaction. Okay, bonus article 16. Turning the tide on obesity, prevention efforts that address all of the many factors that contribute to obesity must be bolstered, not abandoned, to ensure that the next generation will not require lifelong medication to maintain metabolic health. So the pharmaceutical company's kind of driving us into a weird place because, of course, the most profitable drugs are ones that you can give people that you have to take for years on end, in their view, hopefully the rest of your life, so that you're a lifelong customer. But of course, this is very expensive, and drugs have side effects and this type of thing. And it is just weird at a very deep level to think that the only way we can maintain population health is have many or most people on drugs to maintain something as simple as your weight or maintain, quote, metabolic health. Changing topics a little bit, bonus article 17. Artificial intelligence causes real harm. Let's focus on that over the end of humanity hype. So this is one that drills down a little bit to more of the shorter term things that are right in front of us, because we have a lot of good research that shows different harms of artificial intelligence. I've reported on a lot of them in the healthcare sphere and even the public health sphere. I would actually say, can we walk and chew gum? Because I do think the existential end of humanity hype harms are something real, and if we don't deal with them now, we probably be less able to deal with them later. So always about looking forward and planning ahead. But this is a good article kind of covering those issues and asking for a little bit less hype and definitely looking at those things that we know the most real harms that are already documented thus far. Bonus article 18. Thousands of scientists are cutting back on Twitter, seeding angst and uncertainty. So this is a good follow-up to the AI harm. We see already with the algorithms and actually the lack of algorithms in allowing people to make Twitter hate-filled, thousands of scientists are getting off, and they're going to a variety of other places, but it makes it harder to share information widely and freely with scientists and to the general public. Bonus article 19. 1 in 3 men worldwide have genital HPV infection. So, of course, this can cause warts and it can cause cancer in both men and women. As I reported early, screening for cervical cancer was the most effective in preventing cancers and economic loss, which is, of course, a surrogate for our well-being, length of life, and quality of life. So if 1 in 3 men worldwide have genital HPV infection, obviously their partners, that should be an issue as far as sexually transmitted infections as well. Bonus article 20, 81% of infants in the intensive care unit for RSV were previously healthy, born full term. So RSV is this, or the respiratory virus that's common of all ages, kills a lot of old people, some young people. But this point with the infants is that they're very susceptible, don't have a lot of immunity at birth, and also their lungs are smaller, so the insult that they get can do a lot more damage. And the fact that 4 out of 5 of those in the ICU for RSV were previously healthy, born full term, don't have any previous risk factors, shows how dangerous RSV can be. And of course, there is a monoclonal antibody treatment preventively that's being offered starting this fall. This is important for a lot of healthy infants and particularly for those that are higher risk. These, of course, higher risk is higher risk. Bonus article 21. Underwhelming. NIH trials fail to test meaningful long COVID treatments after 2.5 years and over $1 billion spent. So this is really sad for a variety of reasons. This is a good article to kind of look at some of the challenges in moving nimbly in research with new emerging problems like long COVID. But we haven't really done a particularly good job. I did report recently that they are doing a whole nother round of long COVID research. Hopefully that'll pay off more. Bonus article 22. Amid the new normal of COVID, there's an old normal too. Low-income working families and people of color continue to be hit hardest. So COVID's not done with us, and like most public health problems, what is, quote, normal, the old normal, is that, of course, the most vulnerable people get affected the most. In this case with COVID, just like in many other things, it's low-income working families and people of color. Bonus article 23. COVID-19 may trigger new onset high blood pressure. So this is kind of a scary one because, you know, like I reported earlier that, you know, COVID is not the flu. COVID is much worse because it affects so many other organ systems, including our cardiovascular system, which, of course, high blood pressure is like the most common, one of the most serious risks for cardiovascular disease. And the fact that COVID-19 might trigger new onset high blood pressure is of great concern. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, bonus article 24 kind of gets at something I've been pondering maybe the last year or so, much more in depth, meditating upon. And that is, as we see the divide between blue and red states, you know, where will that lead us? Well, this is an interesting one from The Atlantic called Right Price, Wrong Politics. People want to live in states with access to abortion care and liberal policies. they just can't afford to. A lot of that has to do simply with housing costs, but also lower taxes. And because there is kind of a deregulation in a lot of these, even though people there suffer a lot more problems because of lack of deregulation, you don't have to dish out the money. You don't have to pay for effective liberal policies. Okay, let's close out with one that you can use yourself. Bonus Article 25. Just 4,000 daily steps may lower your risk of death, study finds, with additional benefits the more you walk. So this is kind of a mini pet peeve of mine. This is just another study. And of course, as more study and better studies, larger studies are being done, we're finding that the number of steps that you need to get benefits gets lower and lower. I would argue with all of the evidence that we have that not only does any exercise help you, but actually from moving from completely sedentary to just mildly moving around, you actually get the most benefit early on. This is just simply a scientific question about measurement. You have to have a big enough effect to measure, and it's just hard to measure smaller effects. You just need to have larger samples and more rigorous methods and all that kind of stuff. So the point being for yours and my life is just keep moving. Exercise is good for you in a myriad of ways, one of the pillars of health. You can view these and all the other articles reported in this show and every other episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.